fourth case. Mrs. Anderson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I represent the appellant, Alan Anderson, in this matter. The first issue before the court is whether the government breached the plea agreement by failing to move for the third level of acceptance responsibility at the sentencing hearing. The government's admitted that it breached the plea agreement, but because of the plain error rules, the next two prongs are at issue and contested at this point. The first two prongs have been, of course, satisfied by the admission of error.
You know, in order to move to the reduction, the government would have had to falsely inform the court that Anderson spared them the expense and effort of preparing for trial. Wouldn't the integrity of the judicial proceeding be impaired by requiring that kind of false statement rather than by failing to seek that motion? I mean, the government would have to lie.
I think, Your Honor, that's partially true, is that the government would have to say he's gone to 3 days of trial. This is the morning of the fourth day of trial. However, there were two defendants, and at the point where he pled guilty, while I'm sure the government had proceeded and prepared, evidence had not been presented regarding his guilt as to the charges.
Okay, but wasn't it 6 days into the trial?
On the morning of the fourth day of trial, it was 6 calendar days, if I'm recalling correctly, but it was the fourth day of trial as far as starting. We could disagree about that, but I went back last night and counted it, and there are 3 days of testimony. That, of course, includes opening statements and jury selection. And then the fourth day, the morning of the fourth day, is when he pled guilty.
So where did I get 6 days from?
The government's brief does say 6 days, and because it conflicted with what my brief says, I went back and looked and counted the 4 days. It's possible that one of us is in error. And I actually don't know if it makes that much of a difference how many days specifically. We're certainly not saying that he spared the government of preparing for trial completely. But the government did get a benefit from this plea agreement. They got to no longer have him at trial. They dismissed several counts. They dismissed 3 of the counts, including a racketeering count and conspiracy counts, and let him plead guilty to the firearm count. Certainly, back to your original question, there is some balancing here about fairness and integrity of judicial proceedings, because on one hand, you do have this not quite fitting into a third level reduction for acceptance of responsibility. On the other hand, you have the government making a promise in a plea agreement and then later saying, oh, that was an oversight, we didn't mean it, and now the defendant shouldn't get the benefit of the plea agreement. And we see this, unfortunately, in the reverse situation quite a bit. A lot of defendants say, after the plea, and I'm sure this court is aware, I didn't know. I didn't realize what that meant. It was an oversight on my part. And we have the reverse, where the government's saying, we made a mistake, we didn't realize, but the change of plea hearing indicates that all the parties were on the same page at that point and signed the same plea agreement.
What was said in the plea colloquy about this issue, if anything?
The issue itself, the third level, was not specifically brought up. The plea agreement was mentioned. The factual basis was in the plea agreement. But as far as the third level specifically, it was not brought up.
By anybody?
At the change of plea hearing. By anyone. And the change of plea hearing...
How did the error affect his substantial rights? Wouldn't it be difficult to say that it must have affected his final sentence?
It's always difficult to say that it must have affected, because we would have to go back and get into the mind of the district court to say that. But the district court, of course, was capped at 120 months because the guideline range without the third level was above 120 months. With the third level, it would have been below, granted not significantly below, but still below the statutory maximum, and perhaps allowed the district court to feel a little less constrained by that cap and the higher than statutory maximum guideline range. The other way that his substantial rights were affected is that a bargain that he entered into and completed his end of was not held up. The Supreme Court recently decided the Puckett case, which held that plain error can be applied to these types of arguments. The Puckett case found that it wasn't plain error, but the difference between these cases, and they're both about the third level of acceptance, is that in Puckett, the defendant made affirmative actions and, in effect, breached the plea agreement first by committing additional criminal acts. That's not the case in this case. Mr. Anderson changed no position between the plea agreement being entered into and the sentencing hearing. Nothing changed to allow the government to back down from that promise. Of course, we've already touched on the fairness and integrity and public reputation. I'll touch on it again, is that plea bargaining and plea agreements is an enormous part of the criminal justice system. And to have this sort of case really belies the importance of a plea agreement and agreements made in a plea agreement. And certainly understanding that oversights do happen, but in these types of cases where the parties agree on something, it should be scrupulously upheld. The second issue before this court is based on the recent United States versus Gibbs case, which is an interesting case about the findings of guideline ranges for supervised release. And in this case, the district court committed procedural error when it imposed a 3-year term of supervised release without considering applicable guideline range. The statutory term was not more than 3 years. However, the guideline range was 2 to 3 years. And the court did not mention either the statutory or the guideline ranges and failed to consider the 3553A factors when imposing the term of supervised release. This is the same as the United States versus Gibbs case, and of course Gibbs is recent enough that there has not been any other case citing it or following it. But the problem in Gibbs was the court never acknowledged the advisory range was 5 years. In that case, the guidelines range was 5 years. The statutory range, I believe, was 5 to life. The court did not adopt the pre-sentence report, which is the same in this case, and the fact that Gibbs received a higher-than-guideline sentence for his supervised release was not a factor in the court's decision, although that does distinguish it somewhat from this case. Mr. Anderson received the highest guideline range. He could not have received a higher guideline range. The government seems to indicate that the court's consideration of the 3553A factors regarding Mr. Anderson's sentence was enough to show that the court considered those factors regarding the supervised release sentence. However, the factors are applied quite differently when considering how long to imprison someone than considering how long to supervise that person after he is imprisoned, and should be made separately, at least to the extent that they apply differently to a term of imprisonment versus a term of supervised release. And finally, the Gibbs case does not mention a standard review. It was not raised below, or certainly not obviously raised below, from the Gibbs case. The government argues it should be plain error. Under Gibbs, we see no argument for that. It's simply an error that the district court made, a procedural error, which should result in a remand for resentencing in this case. Unless the court has further questions, I will reserve my time.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen.
Thank you.
Ms. Jacobs?
May it please the court, good morning, Your Honors. Michelle Jacobs for the United States. I think I will start with, really, Judge Rovner, your question at the beginning, and that was, essentially, this would have required the government to lie. It was clearly a mistake by the government, obviously, in including or allowing this provision to remain in the plea agreement when the government signed it. So it was a mistake. But in terms of the last prong of the plain error test, in other words, assume for the sake of argument that we get there, this court has discretion as to whether or not to remedy the error. The integrity of these proceedings, and actually the public reputation of these proceedings, would be damaged if the government was required to go back and make this representation, sort of pro forma representation. The Puckett case actually talks about this. Right at the end of the majority opinion, they call it ludicrous, I think is the term that the court uses, that it would be ludicrous for the government to have been required, just like this case, in that case, to recommend acceptance of responsibility given the post-plea conduct. Similarly here, I would submit that it would damage the public reputation of these proceedings if the government was required to do something like that. Now, that's not in any way to try to excuse the government's conduct. We made a mistake. I don't mean to in any way denigrate the importance of plea agreements. They are obviously extremely important contracts. We draft them. We are responsible for the errors we make. We are responsible for this one. But in the end, I would ask this court to choose not to exercise its discretion in trying to remedy this error for that reason, but also because of Judge Randa's statement. I think I didn't bring it up here, but something along the lines of, but for that statutory cap, I think the record is fairly clear. He likely would have imposed an even higher sentence, regardless of whether the government had made this motion or not.
How long was the trial expected to take?
Well, Your Honor,
there were two defendants.
There were two defendants. And with respect to that length of trial question, I tried to pull the docket when I was sitting over here, and unless I go back to my briefcase, I couldn't. I know that the trial started on November 5th. This occurred on November 12th, exactly a week later, which the reason I think is the reason that I had indicated 6 days of trial. I think that's where you got that number. My guess is within that second week, the government anticipated that the trial would conclude.
So, I mean, in other words, did the defendant's decision to plead guilty in fact spare the government time and expense and effort, or?
Well, I mean, were there additional witnesses lined up? Sure. I mean, there was more evidence to come with respect to both defendants. But remember that 3E1.1B talks about sparing the government the trial preparation time. And regardless of a second defendant, there was evidence, I mean, obviously the shooting, it was one of the incidents that the government was going to have to prove up with respect to this defendant and had to prepare with respect to this defendant. And so, ultimately, no, the defendant's decision a week into trial did not spare the government the resources and trial prep time.
What if you plead on the day that the trial is supposed to start? The preparation has all been had?
Well,
I mean, other than night before type.
Right.
So would you say that...
I would say the government should not be entering into a plea agreement agreeing to move for the third point for acceptance of responsibility on the morning of trial. Absolutely not. I mean, anyone who has prepared for trial knows that it doesn't just happen on the night before or in the middle of trial, right? I mean, our trial preparation starts to occur well in advance. And typically, I mean, the practice typically is to send out these plea agreements, as happened here, well in advance of trial, and try to set some deadline. The third point is going to be gone after X date because we got to get going in trial preparation. But again, we made a mistake here in leaving this provision in. What should have happened is it should have been stricken when the defendant walks in with this previously proffered plea agreement, and we didn't do that. Now, with respect to the Gibbs case and the supervised release issue, I would submit that the defense argument in this case really is a suggestion that the district court, that there are some magic words, essentially, that the district court is going to have to say in all future cases before it imposes supervised release. And this court really has said in a lot of other contexts, sentencing contexts, that's not required. That's not the obligation of the district court.
But where in the record is there an indication that the district court was aware of the guidelines range for supervised release?
I acknowledge that the district court does not say the supervised release term is 2 to 3 years. That is not in the sentencing transcript. But the district court repeatedly refers to the pre-sentence report, says he reviewed the pre-sentence report, the defendant says he reviewed the pre-sentence report, and the guideline range for supervised release is clearly set forth in the pre-sentence report. The court imposes a supervised release term within the guideline range, which at least is one distinguishing factor from Gibbs. I mean, Gibbs, you have a situation where the district court doubles the term of supervised release from the guideline range. And I think it also says something along the lines of that the district court never referenced the supervised release term or never referenced the pre-sentence report. I can't recall the exact language, and again, I don't have the case up here, but there's some reference that makes it at least sound as if there wasn't much talk about the pre-sentence report. Here, the district court repeatedly references the pre-sentence report, his reliance on the pre-sentence report in imposing sentence. I think it's also telling with respect to the 3553 angle of this argument that the district court imposes specific conditions of supervised release on this defendant. No gang involvement is a good example. The district court was considering the defendant's personal history and characteristics, the seriousness of the offense, and spent an awful lot of time talking about those aggravating circumstances in analyzing the 3553 factors generally. He then takes all of his discussion about the defendant's longtime gang involvement and imposes a condition of supervised release that the defendant not be involved in gangs. I think that's a pretty good indication that the court was using its 3553 analysis more broadly than just on the prison term. And again, I am not aware of cases in this circuit that say that when the court does such a nice, thorough analysis like Judge Randa did of the 3553 factors, that it has to sort of step away from all of that and start over again with respect to supervised release. If there are conditions that really don't in any way or are not explained in any way by the pre-sentence report and by the court's analysis, sure, the court should give some explanation for why it's imposing some other condition. But what happened here, I would submit...
Harmless error?
Well, certainly harmless error to the extent that this court wants to hear 2 to 3 years of supervised release on the record. Absolutely. And for that reason, I would ask...
Do you concede in harmless error?
I'm sorry?
Are you conceding that this is harmless error?
I'm not conceding that it's error at all, given the explanation in my brief. But to the extent that this panel decides, or this court decides, that it wants to hear, it wants to interpret Gibbs to say that the court must specifically recount the guideline range, actual numbers, on the record before it imposes supervised release, then I would say in this case it was harmless error. If the court has no further questions, I would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Ms. Christensen?
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll start with the Gibbs case. Certainly, Gibbs is an interesting case, and when it came down, we were, shall we say, interested in it because it certainly brought light upon a situation that occurs in a lot of cases where supervised release is thrown in at the end of a sentencing hearing. And certainly to defendants, the sentence of imprisonment is much more important. However, Gibbs has to be reckoned with. It's a published case that this court has recently decided, and it seems to indicate from its plain language that the court needs to at least adopt or mention the pre-sentence report's guidelines range for supervised release.
You would acknowledge that in this case, Judge Randa seemed to be pretty familiar with the PSR.
Oh, certainly. The judge certainly had read the pre-sentence report, and I certainly think that that's true in most cases, that the judge has thoroughly read the pre-sentence report.
I mean, this record reflects...
Yes, that he considered it.
In consideration, sometimes we don't find
right.
as evident in other records.
And part of the difficulty with Gibbs is that there's not a lot of information about what the judge did in that case to compare the two. But given on the face of Gibbs what Gibbs says, this case is similar enough and with the same remand being required. Regarding the breach, like I said, it's a difficult balancing of fairness and public integrity factors. Puckett said it was ludicrous, but that was based primarily on the fact, and no other reason comes to mind, that the defendant in that case, had committed additional offenses. I see my time is up, and I will ask the court to remand for resentencing.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Christensen. Ms. Jacobs, we thank you both. The case is taken under advisement.